Well, let's end Christmas week together, ladies and gentlemen. John Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I hope you had a wonderful and joyous Christmas, and I hope you're continuing to have a wonderful holiday season. Hanukkah underway. It's unusual that Hanukkah and Christmas both fall on the same day. I should say Hanukkah starts on the same day as Christmas. Of course, for traditional Catholics, Christmas is a season. We're now in Epiphany, so that's going to go on for a while. I hope the year ends as well as it has gone for the last couple of months. I've been feeling like every day is Christmas since Election Day, and a lot of stuff going on. I'm in an unusually good mood. The family's all together for Christmas, and all is going well, except, boy, do we have some interesting stuff to talk about in the news. It is amazing to me the lengths to which some Democrats are going to try and prevent Donald Trump from taking the oath of office. Now, you'll recall that we've had an unprecedented use of the legal system to try and ruin Donald Trump, right? And that resulted in him being indicted, which his critics thought would finish him. That Donald Trump being indicted, no country has ever elected a president under indictment. So he got hit with a flurry of them, and it actually increased his public support. People saw through the abuse of power. People don't like the abuse of power. And then, of course, the fiasco in New York City, where he was, air quotes, convicted of 34 felonies, which is, again, just preposterous, absurd, such an open-ended abuse of the legal system. It's going to be overturned on appeal. But they just wanted to be able to say, Donald Trump convicted felon. Now, that's going to finish him. Didn't finish him. He had a record amount of donations flooding into his campaign and his legal defense fund. And so then there was a companion strategy. Well, let's just get his name off the ballot. So 17 states had lined up, were looking at a strategy of removing Donald Trump's name from the ballot so you could not vote for him. Two states actually went to the extent of removing his name from the ballot. Colorado did it through their Supreme Court. I believe it was the state of Rhode Island, whose Secretary of State just said, I don't believe Donald Trump merits being on the ballot. And she just removed his name. Okay, the Supreme Court comes in and, to sum it up in a sentence, said, knock it off. So the attempt, again, not by crazies on the fringes, but by sitting members of a state Supreme Court and an elected elections official back east to try and prevent American citizens from being allowed to vote for Donald Trump. It failed. But had it succeeded, again, there were 15 states ready to do the same thing. And then, of course, there were the pair of assassination attempts. We don't know much about the first one in Butler, Pennsylvania. We don't know much about the first shooter. And it's almost odd how they've come up with next to no information about this guy. The second shooter was an activist Democrat, liberal activist, and had actually, you know, been so much in the tank for supporting Ukraine that he traveled to Ukraine, called Donald Trump a threat to democracy. This is the guy who was aiming for Trump, waiting for him, lining up a shot with a high-powered rifle when Trump was out golfing. Secret Service caught him. And then we have this. There is an online publication, much read in Washington, D.C., called The Hill, as in Capitol Hill. And they ran an op-ed by two men, Evan Davis and David Schulte. Again, these are not crazed leftists ranting on street corners in front of used bookstores. Evan Davis was editor-in-chief of the Columbia Law Review. David Schulte was editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Review. They have both clerked for a Supreme Court justice. One of them served as president of the New York City Bar. The other is a Chicago investment banker. their piece, they are urging Congress not to accept Donald Trump's electoral votes. They said that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, that he's an insurrectionist who is ineligible to be president. They are, in other words, comparing Donald Trump to members of the Confederacy who might have political ambitions to re-enter political office. That's what the 14th Amendment was all about. They say that the Electoral College is counting the Electoral College votes is a matter uniquely assigned to Congress. Under well-settled law, I'm reading from the piece here, this fact deprives the Supreme Court of a voice in the matter because the rejection of the vote on constitutionally specified grounds is a non-reviewable political question. It said, to make an objection requires a petition signed by 20% of the members of each house. If the objection is sustained by majority vote in each house, the vote is not counted and the number of votes required to be elected is reduced by the number of disqualified votes. If all the votes for Trump were not counted, Kamala Harris would be elected president. The unlikelihood of congressional Republicans doing anything that might elect Harris as president is obvious, but Democrats need to take a stand against Electoral College votes for a person disqualified by the Constitution from holding office unless this disability is removed. No less is required by their oath to support and defend the Constitution. Again, these are two eminently credentialed attorneys who are saying, we don't care what the American people said. We don't care that Donald Trump won 31 of the 50 states. Kamala Harris won 19. We don't care that he won all the swing states. We don't even care that he won the popular vote, which even Donald Trump's campaign did not see. We just don't want him taking power. This goes to show just how adamant and impassioned the people who want to cling to power are, that they would be willing to do something like this. Actually declaring that if Congress doesn't want to count the electoral votes for Donald Trump, they don't have to, and there's nothing the Supreme Court can do about it, so they shouldn't do it. Now, who is the real threat to democracy? Remember, Donald Trump was a fascist? Donald Trump was a threat to democracy? And I was telling you while this was going on during the campaign, I said, what you're watching here is just a textbook case of projection. The Democrats are calling Donald Trump a threat to democracy while they are trying to threaten democracy, while they're trying to take his name off the ballot, while they are trying to ruin his name and wreck him personally, politically, economically, through a flurry of legal actions at the city, county, state, and federal level. Donald Trump's beat them all back. So will this succeed? No, it's not going to succeed, but it just shows how ugly the other side is. I'll tell you when else we see the real face of the political left. We see it during U.S. Supreme Court confirmation battles. Remember how ugly the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh became? That somebody who has probably not even met Christine Blasey Ford, she could not even prove that she had met him. By prove, I mean she couldn't even name anyone else who saw her talking to him or recalled her talking about him. Yet she said that he sexually assaulted her at a party where she couldn't name the location of the party, wasn't even sure of the year or month that it happened, but she was at the party with a certain friend of hers. The certain friend that she mentioned said, I don't know what she's talking about. And yet this is the woman. This was presented to people as Brett Kavanaugh did this when he was 15 years old. What an impeccable witness she is that this happened. Therefore, he should not be allowed to become Supreme Court Justice. Oh, and then they tried to bring on another woman who said that he and his friends hosted rape parties in the neighborhood and, quote, everybody knew about them. And they couldn't find anyone who would corroborate any of these details. This is what the left does when they think their grasp on power is slipping away. Unbelievable how ugly they will get. And it shows their real contempt, not only for democracy, but for the truth. Not only for the truth, but their disdain for the American people. So never have I felt better about the decisions the American people made. Decisions meaning not just for president, but giving him a Republican U.S. Senate, giving him control over the U.S. House of Representatives. People say, well, it's not by much. No, it's not by much. But up until Election Day, the odds makers said that Democrats had a 73% to 80% chance of winning control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Oops. So once again, they undercounted the support for President Trump and his party. Oh, we have a busy show today. Yes, 2 days after Christmas, and we still have a busy show. A lot happening. Did you know the state of Oregon is their attorney general, who is their top law enforcement officer, is responding to Tom Homan saying that he's coming to states, particularly those that are marked sanctuary states, and he is going to put a priority on removing public safety threats, i.e., illegal immigrants who are committing crimes while they are here illegally, and national security threats. And so the reaction from Oregon's AG, you would think, would be, well, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, and I certainly believe that we should have, you know, pathway to citizenship for undocumented people who are here in the United States. But if he wants to get rid of public safety threats who are in the country illegally, I'm with him. And if he wants to get rid of national security threats, people who are living here illegally, well, we can't argue with that. This is a chance for us to establish common ground. No, no, not in Oregon. They are preparing a toolkit for people to resist. Again, the top law enforcement officer preparing a toolkit for people living here illegally to avoid complying with the law. That's just part of what we have. Also, I saw a movie on Christmas early evening, and I'm recommending it to you. And no, it's not Wicked. Absolutely is not Wicked. Anyway, it's 21 minutes after 6 o'clock. Young Zach in the house here as the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. And we're back. The John Carlson Show. Little early Beatles there for you.
It's the Matt Gaetz theme song.
That's right. I thought it was that other song sung by Ringo when they broke up. You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine.
Or Michael Jackson's Pretty Young Thing.
Okay, here we go. He's not in the picture anymore. For
Thank
AG.
Goodness. Thank yes. goodness.
So, boy, that would have been weird. Having someone as AG battling what were 20 allegations now?
Something like that.
Something like
Too
that.
Too many.
Enough where I think having him not be in the administration, probably a good thing. There's a few other people with better qualifications. All right. So young Zach, with Philip J. Vandervoort III slacking today, not in. You got the social media sweep ready to go?
I will do my best here on the social media sweep brought to you by the Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Some crazy stuff going down at SeaTac over the holidays. Why don't we start back? I believe this was on the 22nd, if I put the pieces together right. There was an Alaskan Airlines passenger, this coming from Como News here, that after the flight had landed, it was a flight, Alaska Airlines flight from Milwaukee to Seattle. The flight had landed. Passengers were exiting. Apparently, one of the passengers claims she became anxious, opened the emergency exit, and exited onto the wing. Firefighters then helped her off the wing down onto a ramp, and a police crisis team spoke with her and ended up taking her to the hospital to be evaluated. So that was one wild holiday incident taking place at SeaTac right before Christmas.
Sounds like someone who really, really didn't want to go see the relative.
I suppose. Crazy that that happened after the flight, too. You would allegedly have that sort of anxiety reaction once the flight was over. Anyway, just days later on Christmas Eve, you had an unticketed passenger make it through TSA at SeaTac and board a flight headed to Hawaii. The flight never took off. Somehow they were able to find that they had a stowaway passenger. The plane was evacuated and then swept with canine dogs, et cetera, fully cleared, and the flight was able to, after a two-hour delay, go about its trip to Hawaii. However, this is just on the heels of another incident back, if you recall, during the week of Thanksgiving, when you had a stowaway passenger, get on a flight leaving New York, and they actually made it to Paris. So I don't know what this recent uptick is.
How did that happen at SeaTac? How did someone get through without a ticket?
TSA did acknowledge that she was, quote, properly screened, but made it past without a boarding pass.
But you have to show a boarding pass.
Yeah, I don't know if it's...
Before you walk to the screening machines. Am I missing something here?
No, yeah, I mean, that is the protocol. I don't know if she managed to cut the line past that checkpoint. You know, sometimes they'll have the someone checking the boarding passes before they have the person checking IDs. I don't know if she kind of was joined a group. They don't acknowledge that. I don't know how that can happen, and I don't know how it can happen, you know, just a month after a similar incident already taking place.
Interesting.
That's all I've got right now. More, I think we're going to get to some H-1B visa stuff in the next social media sweep. Some trouble in the Doge paradise.
Well, I love how the media is trying to say, oh no, civil war has broken out between MAGA and the elites within the Donald Trump universe, political universe. No, not really. It is actually two sides of the Trump coalition that are talking about different things. And it began with a post, social media post by Vivek Ramaswamy. And again, it's people just choosing to look at it and make their own interpretation rather than address it in a straightforward way. Anyway, I'm glad that you're bringing that up next time we can talk about it. Here's something else that's very interesting. It's not news when you hear a famous, iconic rock star talk about drugs as not a big deal or even suggest legalizing drugs. That's not unusual. You know what's unusual? When a rock legend denounces the legalization of marijuana. And it happened. It's Elton John. Elton John has denounced marijuana being legalized. Quote, I maintain that it's addictive. It leads to other drugs. And when you're stoned, and I've been stoned, you don't think normally. Again, this is Elton John. Legalizing marijuana in America and Canada is one of the greatest mistakes of all time. Elton John. And boy, is he correct. He said, you make terrible decisions on drugs. And he relate some of the things that happened to him that weren't so good because drugs steered him in that direction. How about that? Good for you, Elton John. It is coming up here on 6:31, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. The Seattle Seahawks, maybe with the ugliest win in memory last night against one of the worst teams in football, barely eked out a victory over the Chicago Bears. Our senior sports correspondent going to be telling us more about that. Matthew Carlson coming up on The Commute. Carlson's back. All right. 25 minutes to 7 o'clock. It's not just Carlson that is back. It is because the Seattle Seahawks, in their second-to-last game of the regular season, had one of the ugliest victories they've managed to, you know, a win's a win, I guess. But, man, this was nothing to be proud of. 6-3 over one of the worst teams in football this year, the Chicago Bears. And, of course, what does this mean for the playoff picture? And speaking of football, isn't there a bowl game involving a Washington College happening this evening? So there's enough in sports that we call up our senior sports correspondent on the John Carlson Show, Matthew! All right. Matthew Carlson, senior sports correspondent on the John Carlson Show. How are you this morning?
Oh, good morning, Dad. Just sitting in your office, actually, right now. So
yes.
Got my game notes here and
excellent.
Ready to go.
Okay. So first of all, I'm so glad you're spending Christmas with us. We love it when you're able to fly over and be part of what we got going on. And this game yesterday, PU, but I guess we won.
Well, I'll give you some context. On July 28th, the Seattle Mariners beat the Chicago White Sox 6-3. And on December 27th, I guess we sit here, after the Seahawks beat the Bears 6-3. So there's no way around it. It was a horrendously ugly game. Jason Myers kicked a field goal in the first quarter. He kicked one in the second quarter. The Bears got one in between the Seahawks' two field goals, and that was it. There was no scoring in the second half. It was punts. It was fumbles. It was ugly. It was sealed by an interception by Reek Woolen because the Bears couldn't figure out, again, how to late manage a football game. But it is a win. So the Seahawks go to 9-7. The Bears have lost their last nine.
I have seen two Chicago Bears football games where they had victory within their grasp and they just kind of gave it away. I've seen two Chicago Bear games in the last month where that happened. They are so hapless. What are they, 4-12?
Yes. Now, yeah, they'd be 4-12 now and losers of their last nine. Just a team, you know, there's a team that fired their coach after the Thanksgiving.
Yeah, after that debacle.
Thanksgiving Day game in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So they're a mess. And the win doesn't really inspire confidence for Seahawks fans. It's more of just a shrug your shoulders, like, thank goodness that's over.
So what went wrong?
It's like when Ralphie opened the bunny suit. I mean, in A Christmas Story, I guess it's a gift, but not the one you wanted.
Not the one you wanted. It's a very good way of putting it. He looks like a pink nightmare.
King's Nightmare. Yes.
All right, A Christmas Story is always a great movie to watch during the holidays, even if it's after Christmas. Okay, so why did we do so badly while managing to eke out a victory?
Well, I mean, I think part of it can be, you know, the Bears in Chicago, you have to expect somewhat of a tough defensive game for them. Suspect weather conditions. It was pouring down rain.
42 so degrees, guess, yeah.
Part of it you have to give to the Bears' defense, a part of it.
Okay.
Our defense sacked Caleb Williams 6 or 7 times. He's the most sacked quarterback in the league, one of the most sacked quarterbacks of all time, the number one overall pick from USC. He was just running for his life and getting bulldozed back there. And so part of that, but, I mean, there's no way around it. The Seahawks' offensive inefficiency also on full display. I mean, Geno Smith threw for 180 yards, and that's it. It was just a slog. And the Seahawks absolutely have to do better if they hope to beat the Rams next week. And speaking of the Rams next week, this is where it gets really weird. Seahawks still alive to win the NFC West, but gets complicated.
Okay, so there's two ways to get to the playoffs. You win your division or you win a wild card berth. And I guess that we can't win a wild card berth, but we might actually win our division still. Do I have that right?
That is correct. So the three wild card teams, there will be 7 playoff teams from the NFC, the conference the Seahawks play in. The winner of each of the divisions, the North, East, South, and West, which the Seahawks play in, and then 3 at-large wild card teams. Well, those 3 at-large wild card teams are essentially all wrapped up.
Okay.
2 of them will certainly be going to the Minnesota Vikings and the Green Bay Packers,
who the Seahawks have lost to. Defeated us.
In back West. Yes, both defeated us in the last 2 weeks. And the third one is almost certainly going to go to the Washington, you know, former Redskins, the Commanders, who have 9 wins on the season, as many as the Seahawks have right now. And there's a slew of other teams ahead of the Seahawks in that wild card scenario. Some really weird stuff would have to happen.
Okay, so we have to win our division. How do we do that?
Exactly so. We have to win our division. So the Seahawks are 9-7. The Rams are 9-6. So one would expect, you know, let's say the Rams play Arizona. And if the Seahawks go in, you know, even a game behind, they could win the division by beating the Rams in Los Angeles next week, right? Well, wrong, unfortunately. How the NFL tiebreakers work is it would go all the way down to the 5th tiebreaker, which is strength of victory. So just because you win the last matchup in the season against a division rival doesn't give you the advantage. The Seahawks would be 1-1 because they lost to the Rams at home. So it would go to head-to-head as the first. That'd be a tie. division opponents would also be a tie. And then you go to conference opponents, believe it or not, that would also be a tie.
Wow.
And then like opponents, that's a tie as well. So strength of victory is the total points that you have scored in your wins. And that is what it would have to go to.
Well, would we win that?
Well, essentially, if the Rams lose, the Rams have to lose to Arizona to give the Seahawks a chance at the other tiebreakers. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Including, you know, in order for the tiebreaker for like opponents, the Rams have to lose to Arizona to get the Seahawks to that fifth tiebreaker. So that's a Saturday night game. Rams have already lost to Arizona this year. Seahawks have beat them twice. But if the Rams lose to Arizona and start at 9-7, then the Seahawks can simply win the division by going to Los Angeles
and defeating the Rams.
Okay. It's that simple.
Okay, so the Rams have to lose twice.
9-7, Rams would finish, 9-8. Yeah, the Rams have to lose twice.
Okay. If the Rams beat Arizona Cardinals.
That's okay. Both those teams played in St. Louis back in the day.
That's true. But if the Rams defeat the Arizona Cardinals on Saturday, our season is over, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so because they got to lose two in a row. Okay. And
those other even if the Seahawks beat the Rams again and finish with, I guess, the same record, mm-hmm. the Rams would win those other tiebreakers.
That is really something. Wow. Okay.
So, now, again, I personally, you know, and yeah, maybe a little biased, if you lose to your opponent early in the season but beat them later in the season, I feel like that should be enough to win you your division. Wins the last game?
You would think.
NFL.
All right. So, real quickly, because I think you explained that better than anyone else has, this whole strength of victory criteria for making the playoff. Okay, with that said, there is a bowl game tonight in San Diego, the Holiday Bowl. It's not the Huskies, of course. They're out of bowl contention. Well, yeah, so to speak.
They get their Sun Bowl.
The Sun Bowl. You're right. They get a concession bowl. But the Holiday Bowl is tonight, Washington State University versus the Syracuse Orange.
Yes, the Syracuse Orange, alma mater of, you know,
Herb
Jim
Weisbaum.
Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Herb Weisbaum, if he's listening, good morning, Mr. Weisbaum. Bob Costas as well, his alma mater. And the Holiday Bowl. The Holiday Bowl is a great bowl, or at least it used to be. It used to be a great draw. People look forward to the Holiday Bowl. It was, you know, it wasn't the Cheez-It Bowl or the, you know, super corporatized. It had a reputation. But Washington State, this has been probably one of the worst 3-week stretches in program history. No head coach, no offensive coordinator, no defensive coordinator, no QB coach, no starting quarterback, no running back coach, and 29 players in the portal after head coach Jake Dickert ditched town to go to Wake Forest. Washington State is opening as 18-point underdogs.
Well, who's coaching them tonight, then?
In this game. Coaching them is Pete Kaligis, K-A-L-I-G-I-S. I hope I'm saying that right, who, to his eternal credit, has stuck through the team and has commandeered the starting coaching job on the interim tag. So this is the ultimate underdog story. I mean, Syracuse is a good football team. They're ranked 22nd in the country. They finished fourth in the ACC. Washington State, of course, on that 3-game slide to end the season, finished the season 8-4, but still got a good bowl draw. And they're fighters. They're tenacious.
Okay.
We've seen other teams vacate their bowls, Marshall in particular. But Washington State is sticking to it. And
players that are in the portal, meaning they're poised to transfer to other schools, they're playing tonight, aren't
yes.
they?
Yes. Yeah. Washington State held a team vote, actually, and said they voted for the players in the portal to have the opportunity to play. So I don't, you know, it's the most obvious thing in the world. The system's broken, and college football is broken. But
yeah.
Washington State's going to go out there, and we know those kids are going to try their best. We know this staff is going to try their best. And I encourage, you know, if if you're not doing anything, if you want to go to San Diego, if you're a Cougar, get down there, support the team, and watch the team on TV. Because
okay.
this is it, and this is a big moment for the Cougs.
I think you are right. And it's tonight on Fox, so you don't have to, you know, it's not a streaming on a pay-for.
Yeah, no crazy streaming Holiday Bowl, 5 p.m. on Fox. Gus Johnson on the call, so he's a great announcer. He'll call a good game.
Excellent.
And, so that's the sports rundown.
That's the sports rundown this 27th day of December. Our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson, checking in. Thank you very much, Matthew. Great job as usual, son.
Always a pleasure. Love you, Dad, and Happy New Year.
All right. Katie, love you, too. Okay. It's 49 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning.
A couple very interesting side notes here to bring to your attention. Not only was this not a good election for the Democratic Party nationally, it was a pretty good election for them statewide here in Washington, but not so great nationally. It was not a good year for the mainstream media because it became clear that the mainstream media are no longer mainstream, and it hurt them. Americans began to turn away. Here's what I'm talking about. CNN has wrapped up 2024 with the lowest audience numbers in its history. This is especially unusual because election years usually draw larger audiences to stations like CNN. Here's how bad it is. This is a country of 340 million people. 340 million people. From December of 2023 through mid-December 2024, CNN averaged 488,000 viewers across the country. By way of comparison, Fox News had 1.46 million. In other words, they had three times more viewers than CNN. This poor performance follows less than stellar ratings on election night, where CNN drew 5 million viewers, which was a 44% drop from its election coverage of 2020. Fox, on the other hand, drew 13.5 million viewers. So 5 million to 13.5 million viewers during the same election night. MSNBC had 806,000 total viewers averaged per evening. So when you add CNN to MSNBC, it still is less than Fox News. Still is less than Fox News. Fox's numbers actually went up a tick. So America didn't say no to television news programming, period. They just said no to so-called misnamed mainstream media.
It's after 7 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I sure do appreciate you letting me be part of your listening day. Yes, we got a lot of stuff we got to talk about here this hour of the John Carlson Show. And yes, we are in studio live and local. A lot of people kind of taking the day off, Friday of Christmas week, but there's just too much stuff to talk about. So wanted to come in and get to it. The first story I want to get into is we are now beginning to learn just how epic the egregious, and I will call it out as un-American, the behavior was of Joe Biden's senior staff to hide his infirmities. It was so bad that we have learned in a Wall Street Journal piece published about a week and a half ago that Joe Biden was showing signs of decline months into his first term, the spring of 2021. He took the oath the third week of January, and by early spring, they were starting to make excuses for his difficulty in following things. They drastically simplified his schedule. And here is the really bad part. It wasn't that they were making excuses and, you know, completing his sentences and trying to walk him through things. You know, he would have good days and bad days. It's that when Joe Biden announced that he wanted to run for another term, they didn't try and talk him out of it. And when he went public with his intentions to run again, they organized a campaign to not only continue to hide his cognitive decline and his physical decline, but they trashed anybody who raised questions. Remember, Zach, remember the Wall Street Journal story after Joe Biden's disastrous debate against Donald Trump? And the Wall Street Journal had a story that says, you know, there have been a lot of people talking. And the Wall Street Journal was attacked roundly by the news media for taking things out of context.
Who wasn't attacked after that debate for pointing out the obvious? And I wonder, like you just said, they made an attempt to, hush any concerns when Biden announced he was going to run for president again. I want to know now at this point, was that really his call? Was that his intention, his desire? Or were the people who have kind of been running the show for the past 4 years hoping to get another for themselves?
No, I think it's both. I think Biden didn't want to let it go. I think his wife was adamant that he not let it go. Dr. Jill Biden.
PhD.
Or its equivalent from the Joe Biden School of Public Affairs at the University of Delaware. I'm not making that up. And the people around him who said, hey, I basically get to be president. I get to be one of several shadow presidents. And I don't have to be confirmed by the Senate, and I don't have anywhere near the public disclosure requirements of others. So Scott Jennings from CNN, the one good thing about CNN, was asked what he thought the biggest scandal was in the country. He said, oh, it's not even a close call. It's this.
It's the biggest scandal in America, and the level and volume of people who dedicated themselves to lying to everyone at home about this man's condition for 4 straight years up through this summer is breathtaking. It's a scandal of epic proportions, and it's a fair question to ask who is running the country, who has been running the country. And as I said earlier, if you're worried about Donald Trump's advisors having influence for the last 4 years, apparently this president, duly elected, but this president was not capable of fulfilling the duties of the office, and his staff and the White House lied about it and kept it from the American people. It's an absolute scandal.
Yeah, again, they not only withheld information, but they lied when asked pertinent questions. And they lied like the old slogan, they lied like a bug in a rug. They lied over and over again, and they kept it going. The same Democrats who helped cover for Biden are all right this week having a conniption fit over the political influence of Elon Musk posting on social media that Congress should not vote for the debt ceiling deal, which they did not do. They got a better deal because Elon Musk tweeted out, obviously, after clearing it with the president-elect, that it was a terrible deal that the Republicans were poised to vote for, and they shouldn't do it. And Democrats say, oh, that's unseemly. See, that kind of political influence from someone who's not even elected. The same people who are complaining about some of Donald Trump's advisors having political influence and using it publicly haven't uttered a word of criticism about the White House staffers who were actively misleading, basically carrying out a campaign of not only hiding Joe Biden's infirmities, but trashing anyone who was raising questions about his obvious decline. And I'll tell you something. We are now getting a much clearer picture that the Republicans, far from engaging in what do the Democrats call ageism and, you know, blowing things out of context and putting together doctoring, video bits to make it appear that Joe Biden was confused and didn't know what he was doing. We now know the Republicans were understating it. It was worse than that. These people were ready to push Biden out there for another 4 years. Have you seen Biden lately? I mean, we're in oh my God land.
I think back on that video that we all reposted numerous times of Biden at the D-Day.
Just wandering ceremony, around.
And how much worse, like you just said, how much worse it was than him wandering around in a field. This man was leading the country, or allegedly leading the country, and can barely formulate a sentence.
So, you know, it's easy to say, and I understand why a lot of people are saying it. Okay, that's true, but, you know, look, it's over. In less than a month, it's over. You know, in 4 weeks' time, Donald Trump will be president. You know, 26, 27 more days, Donald Trump will be the next president. We're going to be fine. Yeah, but here's what I want to know. Okay. Now we are learning the extent of Joe Biden's senility. And we now know there was an orchestrated White House campaign to hide it and mislead people and, when necessary, to lie about it. Here's what I want to know. Who was leading this campaign? Who was doing this? I know last week we had a clip of Kamala Harris after Joe Biden's terrible debate performance, excoriating it was a bad debate. He had an off night, and self-righteously claiming that Joe Biden was fine. How about Joe Scarborough from MSNBC's Morning Joe show, who last spring, just weeks before the debate, pronounced Joe Biden has been, quote, best Biden ever. The best Biden we have seen is right now, this year. That was 3 years into his decline. 3 years of steady decline. And all they could think of is, hey, as long as that guy's name remains as president, which is essentially all that's left of him is his name, as long as his name appears, I've got more power than I ever thought I would have before. Again, here in the middle of this controversy about Joe Biden, here was Vice President Kamala Harris.
So the way that the president's demeanor in that report was characterized could not be more wrong on the facts and clearly politically motivated.
Okay, what you just heard was someone who, to use this term again, is projecting. She says that this was a reference to the report by Robert Hur, the special counsel, who said that the grounds existed to charge Joe Biden with knowingly keeping classified information in several different locations, in a downtown D.C. office, in his house, in the garage. I think there were five separate places he was keeping classified documents, and he knew they were classified, and that's a felony. And yes, he could be charged, but he wasn't going to do it because he didn't think a jury would convict someone who comes across as a genial, old, forgetful man. Kamala Harris, as you've just heard here, said that that report was wrong on the facts and was politically motivated. No, she is wrong to say that he was wrong on the facts. He was right on the facts, Robert Hur was, that Joe Biden clearly had engaged in illegal behavior. And it was not he who was politically motivated. It was she who was politically motivated in misleading people. So to go back a little bit and then continue with her statement.
The report was characterized, could not be more wrong on the facts, and clearly politically motivated, gratuitous. And so I will say that when it comes to the role and responsibility of a prosecutor in a situation like that, we should expect that there would be a higher level of integrity than what we saw. Thank you.
Oh, he's the one with the integrity problem, is he? Again, he was absolutely correct. This was just a couple of months before the debate, the Robert Hur report. just a couple of months before the debate.
What facts were wrong? I never heard anybody dispute anything factually about that case.
No, Robert Herr had it exactly right. Again, this was the Asian special prosecutor who interviewed Joe Biden. And by the way, they spent a week prepping him for his discussion, his conversation with Robert Herr. And Robert Herr said, well, you know, after the meeting, which, of course, the meeting did not go well because Biden couldn't conduct the meeting on a teleprompter. And he said, you know, he's dead to rights. He's legally culpable, breaking the law here, but I'm not going to try him. I just don't think a jury would convict him. He's being in the state he's in. And, of course, here comes the White House trashing Robert Herr for lying, which he did not, for being politically motivated, which he wasn't. If he's politically motivated, he would have gone ahead and charged him. And then, for good measure, trashing his integrity. He's the one with integrity. These people in the White House wouldn't know what integrity looks like. Oh, I'm so glad we kept her away from the Oval Office. Think of all the sycophants for sale who went out on behalf of Oprah. Kamala Harris! What a long way she's fallen in public esteem. That's the one thing I do like about this election is the Democrats are tearing each other apart. Oprah's influence and prestige definitely took a hit. George Clooney's influence took a hit. Barack Obama's stature really got cut down to size. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi. It couldn't have happened to a nicer group of people. Really could not have happened to a nicer group of people. Okay, we have a lot of other things straight ahead on the John Carlson Show, including young Zach with the social media sweep. We also have, in the state of Oregon, their attorney general is setting up a resistance campaign, a toolkit to resist cooperating with Donald Trump's attempt to carry out mass deportation of criminals, illegal aliens who have committed crimes while living here illegally. I've got the details straight ahead. It's all right. And so is young Zach's social media sweep. He's got a great report straight ahead. Here we go.
Like Tom Petty, I'd say it's all right. Social media sweep brought to you by the Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This hour's social media sweep, rather, is a one story and one story only, but I think it'll carry us all the way.
Okay.
New discussion over H-1B visas that broke out on Christmas via a string of tweets, I think prompted originally by Elon Musk. I've tracked the X, Twitter, all these threads and strings. It's hard to track down exactly where it originates. I think this is either the first or close to the first tweet that kicked off this debate. Elon Musk writes, if you want your team to win the championship, you need to recruit top talent wherever they may be, and that enables the whole team to win. Musk goes on, I am referring to bringing in via legal immigration the top 0.1% of engineering talent as being essential for America to keep winning. Thinking of America as a pro sports team that has been winning for a long time and wants to keep winning is the right mental construct. Vivek Ramaswamy, fellow chair, would you call it, of the DOGE administration, DOGE committee?
Co-chair. Yes.
Co-chair of
Department
DOGE.
Of Government Efficiency.
Yes, named after the meme Shiba Inu dog, DOGE, namesake of the DOGE coin as well. Vivek Ramaswamy goes on to back up Musk, citing culture, quote, that America culture has veneered mediocrity over excellence, citing portrayals of smart students in TV sitcoms, Boy Meets World, which is one of the trending hashtags right now. So anyway, this has sparked quite a debate amongst, if you believe the headlines on CNN and Newsweek and whatever, MAGA backlash. And of course, you have people like Ann Coulter and Breitbart digging up old J.D. Vance quotes from 2022, citing that the new Congress needed to repeal H-1B visa rights and privileges. Ann Coulter getting in on the action, Laura Loomer getting in on the action, many people criticizing Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy with a lot of concerns over what this may mean for the new administration.
Well, first of all, there's two different tacks here. H-1B visas are supposed to be for specialists doing jobs you can't hire Americans to do. This program has been abused. We've seen it with particular clarity here, and a lot of people make it racial because a lot of the visa H-1B visa applicants are from India, and they displace Americans who tend to be white tech workers. But it's not racial. It is a case of simply bringing in immigrants to the tech sector who will do the same job for less money than American computer engineers. Just like we see with blue-collar labor, drywallers, meat packers, people who work in manufacturing plants.
Agriculture.
The same thing. Well, you can have guest workers in the agriculture sector, but then they used to go back home at the end of the planting season. Now they stay year-round and just go off to these other jobs that I just mentioned. And so this is basically kind of a highfalutin form of illegal immigration. And the reason why tech companies love H-1B visas is they don't have to worry about their employees leaving to get a better job. Because if the visa is held by the company. If you leave the company, you go back home. So they don't have to, Microsoft doesn't have to worry about losing an H-1B employee to Google or to Meta, Facebook. So that's why you have this problem. The H-1B problem. What Elon is talking about is getting not, the top 5%, but the top 0.1%. Basically, the kind of people who figured out for his SpaceX company how to parallel park a heavy-duty rocket booster back into the same platform from which it was launched days earlier. Okay, that you're talking about a specialized level of knowledge. So Elon's got a good point here.
That's his point, and that's what he says. I don't know if that's what he means. We'll find out, I guess, later on that. But I have a bigger issue that I think doesn't get discussed as much. We often bring up the issue of the H-1B visas, but I think the education visas is a much bigger issue. I'll be quite candid. I was admitted to the University of Washington, senior in high school, but they said straight up, you may not pursue engineering at the University of Washington. They have these direct to college. They don't want, a bunch of students incoming to universities going into expecting to go into engineering, computer science, nursing, business, et cetera. They limit that to a very specific number of students who are incoming. Now, what that does, too, is prioritizes out-of-state students, international students. And so the opportunities for American students to get degrees and study these sort of tech job fields is very limited. And I think that's something that should be addressed before we go chasing down H-1B visa concerns.
Wow. Okay. So great conversation. I think, again, the whole argument is a lot of people are attacking Musk and Ramaswamy for talking about what I thought was the 0.1% that we want to cultivate excellence with an expansion of the H-1B visa program, which is already being abused for the reasons that we just outlined. All right. You are listening to The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. When we come back, the state of Oregon has laid out their strategy. They're going to try and resist Tom Homan, try and prevent him from success in his mass deportation program. You'll hear what they have in store and what Tom Homan thinks about it. And it's all straight ahead on The John Carlson Show. 23 minutes now to 8 o'clock in the morning. So it's very interesting that Bob Ferguson, who was very loud and proud resistance leader to Donald Trump when he won in 2016, has been kind of quiet about Donald Trump, though he did assign a unit of his administration to delve into and pour into the 2025 plan, which isn't even from Trump. It's basically a report put out by the Heritage Foundation about how Trump might be threatening democracy. Okay, fine. You go ahead and do that. Unfortunately, it'll be at taxpayer expense. But, you know, you want to review the Heritage Foundation's work? Have at it.
Would that make it peer reviewed?
Yeah. The second is you don't hear Nick Brown, the newly elected Democratic Attorney General. You don't hear him saying much about Donald Trump either. But in Oregon, their attorney general, her name is Ellen Rosenblum, she has announced what she calls a bilingual sanctuary promise community toolkit to help residents fully aware of what their rights are. She says every person has the right to live, work, play, and learn safely in Oregon, period. Again, it's amazing that the top law enforcement officer in Oregon makes no distinction between people who are living in Oregon legally and people who are living there illegally. They all have a right. So people living in Oregon illegally have a right to live and work in Oregon, period, which is flat out factually untrue. Quote, I asked my civil rights unit here at the Oregon Department of Justice to do whatever we could to provide the people, businesses, and local governments of our state with easy-to-read materials to help them know their rights and educate others. I'm so pleased with what they put together. The toolkit includes frequently asked questions like, how do I prepare myself and my family for encounters with ICE or other federal immigration authorities? Is there a place I can call to report ICE right now in my community? Oregon also has a statewide hotline to report violations of sanctuary law. Again, they don't have hotlines for other kinds of violations of your rights, but if you're in the country illegally, they've got a hotline for you to call. She says it's important that Oregonians discuss with family the importance to know your rights. Make a plan what to do if immigration officials come to your home or place of business. Knowing your rights in advance is essential. Nothing here about knowing what your responsibilities are to obey the law, including federal immigration law. So this came up on, I believe it was Fox and Friends, and they were discussing the border. And Tom Homan was asked, what do you say, you know, to those who say that it's inhumane to put barriers up against people who just simply want to move here and have better life? His response is priceless. Listen to this.
Open borders are not humane. The only thing
he just said, the first part of it was cut off there. He says, open borders are not humane. Thing about Tom Homan is he's a smart guy who speaks very rapidly, so you have to listen to him carefully. Here we go.
They're not humane. The only thing on that border right now that is humane are the men and women wearing that green uniform. They save thousands of lives every year. I've seen these men and women give CPR to babies that were thrown into the river by the cartel, because when they're chasing the boat of a smuggling load, it's what the cartel members do, throw the baby in the water, then the border patrol have to jump in the water and save that baby rather than arresting the smuggler. Look, I've held dying children, I've held dead children. I've talked to little girls as young as 9 that were raped multiple times by criminal cartels. The border, open borders, cause death. They cause a rise in sexual assault of females and children. Under this administration, open border, sex trafficking is up over 600%. The number of people off the terrorist watch list is at a historic high. The amount of fentanyl coming across the open border have killed over 250,000 Americans. And that's just what open borders does. When President Trump had the most secure border in my lifetime, illegal immigration down 90%. When 90% less people were coming, how many babies weren't dying? How many women weren't being sexually assaulted? How many no-inspected terrorists didn't make in the country? How many pounds of fentanyl didn't get in the country to kill Americans? Secure borders saves lives. But it's, and that's where the humanitarian piece comes into place. Under Joe Biden, historic number of aliens have died crossing that border, 4,000. A quarter million Americans have died. The open border policies are killing aliens at record numbers, killing Americans at record numbers, and we're going to put a stop to it. We're going to secure the border. As far as sanctuary cities, I find it hard to believe that any mayor or governor wants to push back on ICE because the president's been very clear. Right out of the gate, we're going to concentrate on public safety threats and national security threats. What elected official wants to tell his constituency, I'm okay with public safety threats in my community. I don't want ISIS help to remove these public safety threats. That's their number one responsibility, the safety and security of the public, of their communities. If they don't want to do it, ICE is going to do it. And with all the death threats and all the negative press right now, they can keep screaming all they want. ICE is going to do this job. I'm going to do this job. We're going to make these communities safer. And we're going to enforce the law. And if they can, if they don't want to help, instead decide don't help, fine, don't help. But don't get in our way. And I've said this for the past week over and over again. Do not harbor and conceal an illegal alien, knowingly harbor and conceal an illegal alien from us because it's a crime. Don't impede us because it's a crime. Don't obstruct because it's a crime. If you want to sit aside and let us do your job of securing the communities, fine, we'll do that. But don't cross that line.
I so love this guy. He is the best thing about the Trump administration so far. This is a guy who's been doing immigration for 40 years, law enforcement for 40 years. He actually was doing this during the Clinton administration, and he held an appointed post in the Obama administration. And he was actually heralded for his work in the Obama administration. So this is a guy who understands what needs to be done, and he understands how to do it. This is what we need. Tom Homans at every, in every cabinet level office. We need people who know what needs to be done and how to do it. And as you can hear, this guy is utterly fearless. And he's not fearless because he's not aware of the pitfalls of tangling with these mayors or these governors or attorneys general or county executives. He says, I know the law is on my side. I know when the law is on my side, when it's not. He said, when these mayors, these governors say that they're not going to cooperate in helping to enforce federal immigration law, all right, fine, don't. But we'll do it without you. He says, if you don't want to give us access to your jails where, you know, we could have one guy, one gal there who in the jail who is responsible for knowing when inmates who are in the country illegally finish their sentence and are, is about to be released. If you don't want to clue us in, if you don't want to help us out on that, you don't have to. But we'll just send a team of people to monitor everybody coming out of the every inmate who's being released. And by the way, here's something you need to consider. There's a lot of people who work in corrections that are more than happy to tip off ICE. There's plenty of patriotic people who believe in enforcing the law, that the law should be respected, who are going to be more than willing, more than happy to let ICE know when illegals are being released. So they just need to know that ICE is going to be aggressively doing that job. And I think that is going to be the case because Tom Homan's running it. All right. Still to come on the Commute with Carlson. How did the military vote in 2024 compared to 2020? Well, those numbers have now come in. I'm going to share them with you here on the Commute with Carlson. Plus, Democrats are caught leaking their tax plans and how to sell them to Republicans. It's kind of an oopsie. We'll be sharing that with you as well. As the Commute with Carlson continues, it is 11 minutes to 8 o'clock in the morning. So I found a movie for you. And no, it's not Wicked. Lots of great movies released, of course, this time of year. It's, you know, the Christmas rush, and then there's the summertime movie rush. But there is a movie that surprisingly had a sold-out performance. I went to Lincoln Square Cinemas on Christmas early evening and watched the movie A Complete Unknown, which is taken from a line in the song you just heard, Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. Bob Dylan is 83 years old. He's still touring. He's still out there.
Opens up for the young buck Willie Nelson.
Yes, that's right. When Willie's running a little behind, when Willie at age 90 is running late, they got Bob Dylan.
If he keeps after it, he'll headline one day.
Sweet Bird of Youth is there to open for Willie Nelson. Now, Bob Dylan, you know, still has it, and he's still making albums. But, of course, he, more than any other performer, helped define the music and culture of the 1960s. It was Bob Dylan and the Beatles. And the movie, A Complete Unknown, is about his early years. And that is when, at the age of 19, he left. Robert Zimmerman left Hibbing, Minnesota for New York, and within 8 months had a record contract offered him when he received a glowing review in the New York Times. One article in the New York Times made his name, got him a record deal. The movie is about his early days in New York City, which was a place where a 19-year-old with not a lot of money could afford a place in Greenwich Village. The conflict in the movie is that leaders in the folk music community, we're talking about Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, these folks took their music and its messaging very seriously. They saw Bob Dylan as the next big thing in folk music. And sure enough, Bob Dylan had two songs that helped define the 1960s in a very big way. One was called Blowin' in the Wind, and the second, which he debuted, I believe, at the Newport Folk Festival in 64, was The Times They Are a-Changin'. But Bob Dylan did not want to be just a protest singer, and he didn't want to be just a folk life, a folk singer. He didn't want to be a niche performer. He wanted to become an icon. He wanted something much, much bigger. And he felt this way back in his early 20s. He had the presence of mind to push this. So if you have a chance, go see this movie. Again, it's called A Complete Unknown, The Early Years of Bob Dylan. It's a great movie about what America was like at that time. And even though he was immersed very much in a liberal world, the movie was actually pretty level. No, it was not propaganda. In fact, most of the people he pushed back on were liberal propagandists who wanted Bob Dylan to be a vehicle for them and their cause. And Dylan, again, wanted bigger things. Songs like this one, Knocking on Heaven's Door. It is coming up here on 2 minutes to 8 o'clock. Let's get to your 8 o'clock headlines. Hour number three of the commute straight ahead.
Thank God it's Friday.
Friday of Christmas week. Hope you had a wonderful Christmas. It is 4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning on the commute with Carlson. And still, oh man, a lot of stuff that is going on here that we have been able to cover. And we'll continue to cover. One of the things that I teased a moment ago is that an email sent by State Senator Noelle Frame. Noelle Frame is Democrat from North Seattle, 46th District. She is the chief tax hiker in Olympia. She is the person who thinks that Washington State is still undertaxed. She wants taxes raised on large businesses. She wants taxes raised on small businesses. She wants people to pay more at the pump in energy taxes. And of course, she especially wants to tax wealthy people, not for what they earn, but simply for what they are worth. In other words, they're not saying we should have an income tax and tax X amount of income you earn. She simply says, if you're worth a certain amount of money, we should be able to tax you on that as well. Okay, that is Noelle Frame. We've had her on the show before, and it's not a surprise that Noelle has plans to try and pay the bills of Olympia, not by reducing spending, not by cutting spending, which, by the way, they've made zero effort to do in the entire dozen years that Jay Inslee was governor. There was never, ever any attempt to reduce the size and scope of government or reduce unnecessary expenditures. It was always adding, always adding. So she sent out a series of options, a menu, and said it was for, quote, internal purposes only, not to be shared publicly. Well, guess what? It's being shared publicly. A number of Republican legislators are posting it online. The documents show that the Democrats are seriously considering a wealth tax, which I just mentioned. This is what Jay Inslee didn't dare propose this in his 12 years of office, but as he's literally walking out the door, he proposed it last week. And the capital gains tax that has only been in place for a couple of years, they're already looking to increase that. They are looking at creating a statewide version of Seattle's jumpstart tax on high salaries. They would try and get around the prohibition on state income taxes, not by taxing an employee's income, but taxing the employer's payroll. Get it? It's an income tax, but not on the employee. The income tax is on the employer. Currently, local government is only allowed to raise property taxes 1% a year plus revenue from new construction. They are looking at tripling that, allowing local government to charge more than 3% a year, or collect 3% a year in higher property tax revenue. They're not finished. They're thinking of levying a new tax on homes that sell for more than $3 million. They're still not done. They might want to impose a 11% tax on guns and ammunition. So you would have your 10-cent sales tax, and then on top of that, an additional 11% tax on guns and ammunition, just because they don't want you to own guns. And if you're going to own a gun, which is something they would really prefer you not do, fine, you'll pay for it. We'll punish you. Not only that, they're looking at taxing if you have storage units. Noelle Frame was asked about all this, and she admits that the memo she sent out was accurate. It's genuine. And she said, I inadvertently started conversation the week of Christmas. I'd much rather be making a gingerbread house with my four-year-old. To be clear, there are a lot of conversations happening out there. In her email, she asked for legislators to consider sponsoring some of her ideas. Quote, let's spread the tax policy love around, she wrote. Again, let's spread the tax policy love around. State Senator Linda Wilson said she wasn't surprised. They have an insatiable appetite for more revenue, which is more taxes on more people. Their mindset is that anyone making more money than them is a villain, close quote. By the way, the word villain is quite literally the language used by Noelle Frame, because she accompanied her memo with talking points. And again, this is what the Democrats do so much better than Republicans, is they are better at crafting messages. And this is the important part, staying on message. So they have, here's what you do say, here's what you don't say. So here's what they say you should say when you're selling higher taxes. Don't say you want to tax the rich, or don't say you want people to pay their fair share. Simply say you want people to pay what they owe. Well, if they owe it, you wouldn't need to raise taxes because they already owe it. But again, that's their language. They want to raise taxes on wealthier people. Pay what they owe. Don't say tax the rich. Also, don't say we want to invest in this or that. No, no. say, we want to ensure we have this or that. Also, she says, avoid centering the tax or talking in vague terms about the economy or education. She says, center the needs and well-being of real people and be specific. In other words, bring it down to the human level. If I were trying to sell a tax increase, that's what I would do. Also, again, in the advice, the best ways to talk taxes, meaning tax increases, don't say, don't focus on the budget hole. Focus instead on proposed solutions and how it makes people's life better. Don't say tax burden or tax relief. Do say shared responsibility. And here's your important part in the category do say, be specific about the villain. Talk about the wealthy few and those who wrote our flaw. Grammatical error here. Who wrote our flawed tax code 100 years ago. Actually, our flawed tax code written 100 years ago was written for the most part by populists and by working class people. Legislators in the 1920s, we were in the middle of a populist revival. They say it's very important that when you talk about villains, do not villainize in sweeping generalizations. Be specific about the villain. Talk about the wealthy few. So she has no problem saying that you should look upon these people in very bad or negative terms. Now, it's interesting. One of the taxes that she supports is the wealth tax. And she's immediately getting blowback from one of the wealthiest Democrats and the most wealthy Democrat activists in Washington. That's Nick Hanauer, who was an early investor in Amazon, worth a whole lot of money. And I've gotten to know him over the years slightly. He said the wealth tax, which simply taxes people based on what they are worth, not what they buy, not what they sell, not what they earn, simply what they are worth. For instance, if you're worth $20 billion, well, I'll give you an example. Jeff Bezos's former wife, his ex, Madeline Scott, is worth about $35 billion. She's giving much of it away, but her wealth keeps growing because Amazon stock is doing so well. So the wealth tax says if you're worth $35 billion, you should have to pay $350 million just to live here. That's the wealth tax. You would owe $350 million, 1% of your wealth, just to live here. About $1 million a day because we let you live here. Hanauer says this proposal is impractical, has serious legal issues, likely wouldn't survive a ballot challenge. It is not a serious proposal. Won't solve our budget problems because it's unlikely to bring in revenue. Again, this would be a 1% annual tax on the worldwide holdings exceeding $100 million for Washington residents. Inslee's office said it would bring in $10 billion over 4 years. A recent report from the Department of Revenue said, the wealth tax would be, quote, daunting to administer. Points out, as Hanauer does, that there's obvious legal challenges and questions about how you value overseas assets of billionaires and the risk that a lot of wealthy people would simply relocate. Hanauer said, even if it clears the legal implementation and other legal challenges, it's unlikely to raise very much, given that every wealthy person I've spoken to in the last few days has said they will leave the state. I believe them. Thoughtful taxes don't actually drive people away. Boneheaded taxes do. Noelle Frame, the state senator who likes this idea, who has sponsored previous wealth tax bills, says that Hanauer's criticisms are unfair. It is the right thing to do. That's not much of an argument. It is legal. She doesn't know that, and she's not a lawyer. It is implementable. Well, the Department of Revenue says otherwise, and they do this for a living. And I believe the revenue will come in. Oh, you believe it, do you? Anyway, so that's the extent of her defense. So that is what is in store. And you know what? I love the idea of what was the term they used against Donald Trump 8 years ago? Resistance. I love the idea of setting up a resistance against any further tax increases, because the people of Washington State, believe it or not, are already making it clear that they don't think Washington's on the right track. Every place outside King County believes we are on the wrong track. That's what the polls showed. Every county outside King County believes we're on the wrong track, and King County, only by a 53-47 margin, believe we're on the right track. So the Times, I think the Democrats are misreading the mood of Washington State, and I think the time is ripe for rebellion and resistance to what they're doing. It will be good, as we're chalking up victories in Washington, D.C., to see the one-party regime in Olympia, the Democrat regime in Olympia, lose battles. But that'll be up to you and me and a whole lot of other people, right? Okay, it's coming up on 22 minutes after 8. Young Zach with his favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists on The Commute with Carlson. Talk Radio 570 KVI. 26 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, Friday morning of Christmas week. The John Carlson Show, great having you with me. Yes, I'll be here Monday and Tuesday next week as well. Young Zach, what's going on in the social media world?
Well, I swear it's like an AM, PM, because there is too much good stuff on the social media sweep. Social okay. Media with Socialists, brought to you by the Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Let's start with Starbucks, shall we? You recall the strike they went on last several days leading up to Christmas, 5 days leading up to Christmas? You know what became of that?
Tell me.
Absolutely nothing.
Aw. Aw.
Are you familiar with what their exact, or part of their exact demands were, John? What their, they wanted a wage increase. Do you know how much?
You know, I just looked at it, rolled my eyes, and paid no attention because Christmas was coming. And
sure. So you went to a non-unionized Starbucks, got a latte, and went on your way. This strike, of course, was amongst the unionized Starbucks locations. I think I saw it was about 300 locations nationwide.
Weren't they marching in front of the Soto Starbucks?
Soto Starbucks, the Roastery. They were right down here on near us on Elliott by the Taco Time that I saw them out picketing on Christmas Eve morning. So the federal
stay
minimum.
Stay away from the Taco Time. Boycotting Taco Time, picketing Taco Time, that's un-American.
Certainly un-northwest of them.
Yes.
The federal minimum wage, of course, $7.25. Starbucks minimum wage nationwide, $15 an hour, but the average is $17.50 for a Starbucks employee, which is not too shabby for a job like that. So they wanted, Starbucks said in a statement that the union had proposed an immediate increase in the minimum wage of hourly partners by 64%, as well as an overall 77% raise over 3 years.
What?
Yeah. So
they wanted about $25 an hour?
Yeah, I think it was around that number, yeah.
So these are the Starbucks locations where you can spend $7.50 for a latte.
Yeah, and that latte, obviously, there's a lot that goes into it as why it costs so much. So I thought I'd recap some of the benefits that Starbucks offers their part-time employees. This is here from their website. And my wife worked at Starbucks all through college, and it was not just a good part-time job. It was a great part-time job. And here's just some of the reasons. They offer they call it Bean Stock, the yearly grant of restricted stock units, which vest over 2 years. 401k, they'll match the first 100% of the first 5%. They have some college financial assistance, as well as some partners. You can go get a degree. I think that's fully on them. Family expansion reimbursement, medical, dental, and vision. That's for part-time employees. If you're a transgender individual, they will reimburse up to $500 for you to help get your name changed. Free mental health benefits, paid parental leave, partner and family sick time, student loan resources, incentivized savings program, up to $1,000 per year match in volunteer hours, and even part-time employees accrue time, paid time off. So those are just some of the benefits that Starbucks offers their part-time employees, in addition to a pretty generous wage. And I'd like to coin a new term here, John.
Yes, I can't wait.
Corporate privilege. I wonder if any of these, there's a reason these Starbucks employees are working at a Starbucks and not a mom and pop coffee stand down, you know, in your local neighborhood. Why, if they are so fed up with Starbucks, why don't they go work there? And I think it's because they like all these benefits. They like the privilege that working for a large corporation that kind of can offer these sort of benefits offers them that they won't get, at Joe's Cup of Joe down the street.
I think that you put it very aptly that if they don't like the wage they get at Starbucks, why not just go down the street? And the answer is because they won't get as good a benefits, and they won't get as dependable a work schedule, and they won't get the same wages. They're basically just, this is, we hear about corporate greed. Maybe it's time we start seriously considering the damage done by union greed, because that's what you have right now at Starbucks. $17.50 an hour, and they want a 64% immediate raise. Really?
And this is not Boeing. This is not, it's not saying that's not work, but it's not skilled labor. And it's not something, there's not one airplane manufacturer in town. There's not one coffee shop
in town. Well, people will stop going, and the prices will have to not just go up 15 cents. They would have to go up several dollars per drink. And if you make a really great living, okay, you can handle that. But most people go to Starbucks, are not in the upper 1%.
No.
Okay? You just got to shake your head. They are going to wreck that company.
It's one of the best hourly,
that company.
Best places, part-time places to work in the country. And we'll see if it continues to be so.
All right. Great report. When we come back, oh boy. Yeah, the Seahawks won, but last night against the Chicago Bears, man, it was ugly. Our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson, joins us to tell us more, coming right around the corner of the Commute with Carlson. A little country music there for Lisa Carlson, who likes her country music.
She cranked the Hank?
She also, when it's not 9 to noon, or when it's not 6 to 9 in the morning. Anyway, our good friends down the hall, 101.5, Crank the Hank. She also likes listening to our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson, who joined me this morning to talk about the very ugly Seattle Seahawks victory last night, but it kept us alive and still gives us a chance at making the playoffs. What are those chances? Well, Matthew explains just how it will come about. But first, that game last night. The Seattle Seahawks, in their second-to-last game of the regular season, had one of the ugliest victories they've managed to, a win's a win, I guess. But, man, this was nothing to be proud of. 6-3 over one of the worst teams in Bears. And of course, what does this mean for the playoff picture? And speaking of football, isn't there a bowl game involving a one?
And over the whole world.
This evening. So there's enough in sports that we call up our senior sports correspondent on the John Carlson Show, Matthew.
I was sitting with Matthew. We were watching TV. He said, "Hey, Matthew, what do you see? Do their faces? Do you know their names? Hey, hey, Matthew, what do you see?"
All right. Matthew Carlson, senior sports correspondent on the John Carlson Show. How are you this morning?
Oh, good morning, Dad. Just sitting in your office, actually, right now. So
yes.
Got my game notes here and
excellent.
Ready to go.
Okay, so first of all, I'm so glad you're spending Christmas with us. We love it when you're able to fly over and be part of what we got going on. And this game yesterday, PU, but I guess we won.
Well, I'll give you some context. On July 28th, the Seattle Mariners beat the Chicago White Sox 6-3. And on December 27th, I guess we sit here,
yes,
after the Seahawks beat the Bears 6-3. So it was there's no way around it. It was a horrendously ugly game. Jason Myers kicked a field goal in the first quarter. He kicked one in the second quarter. The Bears got one in between the Seahawks' two field goals, and that was it. There was no scoring in the second half. It was punts. It was fumbles. It was ugly. It was sealed by an interception by Reek Woolen because the Bears couldn't figure out, again, how to late manage a football game. But it is a win. So the Seahawks go to 9-7. The Bears have lost their last nine.
I have seen two Chicago Bears football games where they had victory within their grasp and they just kind of gave it away. I've seen two Chicago Bear games in the last month where that happened. They are so hapless. What are they, 4-12?
Yes. Now, yeah, they'd be 4-12 now, and losers of their last nine. Just a team. You know, there's a team that fired their coach after the Thanksgiving.
Yeah, after that debacle.
Thanksgiving Day game in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So they're a mess, and the win doesn't really inspire confidence for Seahawks fans. It's more of just a shrug your shoulders, like, thank goodness that's over.
So what went wrong?
It's like when Ralphie opened the bunny suit. I mean, in A Christmas Story, I guess it's a gift, but not the one you wanted.
Not the one you wanted. It's a very good way of putting it. He looks like a pink nightmare.
Pink nightmare. Yes.
All right, A Christmas Story is always a great movie to watch during the holidays, even if it's after Christmas. Okay, so why did we do so badly while managing to eke out a victory?
Well, I think part of it can be, you know, the Bears in Chicago, you have to expect somewhat of a tough defensive game for them. Suspect weather conditions. It was pouring down rain.
42
so
degrees.
Guess part of it you have to give to the Bears defense, a part of it.
Okay.
Our defense sacked Caleb Williams 6 or 7 times. He's the most sacked quarterback in the league. One of the most sacked quarterbacks of all time. The number one overall pick from USC. He was just running for his life and getting bulldozed back there. So part of that, but I mean, there's no way around it. The Seahawks' offensive inefficiency also on full display. I mean, Geno Smith threw for 180 yards and that's it. It was just a slog. And the Seahawks absolutely have to do better if they hope to beat the Rams next week. And speaking of the Rams next week, this is where it gets really weird. Seahawks still alive to win the NFC West, but gets complicated.
Okay, so there's two ways to get to the playoffs. You win your division or you win a wild card berth. And I guess that we can't win a wild card berth, but we might actually win our division still. Do I have that right?
That is correct. So the three wild card teams, there will be 7 playoff teams from the NFC, the conference the Seahawks play in. The winner of each of the divisions, the North, East, South, and West, which the Seahawks play in, and then 3 at-large wildcard teams. Well, those 3 at-large wildcard teams are essentially all wrapped up. Two of them will certainly be going to the Minnesota Vikings and the Green Bay Packers,
both
who the Seahawks have lost to.
Both defeated us.
In back-to-back weeks. Yes, both defeated us in the last 2 weeks. And the third one is almost certainly going to go to the Washington, you know, former Redskins, the Commanders. Who have 9 wins on the season, as many as the Seahawks have right now. And there's a slew of other teams ahead of the Seahawks in that wild card scenario. Some really weird stuff would have to happen.
Okay, so we have to win our division. How do we do that?
Exactly so. We have to win our division. So the Seahawks are 9-7. The Rams are 9-6. So one would expect, you know, let's say the Rams play Arizona, and if the Seahawks go in, you know, even a game behind, they could win the division by beating the Rams in Los Angeles next week, right? Well, wrong, unfortunately. How the NFL tiebreakers work is it would go all the way down to the 5th tiebreaker, which is strength of victory. So just because you win the last matchup in the season against a division rival doesn't give you the advantage. The Seahawks would be 1-1 because they lost to the Rams at home. So it would go to head-to-head as the first. That'd be a tie. Division opponents would also be a tie. And then you go to conference opponents. Believe it or not, that would also be a tie.
Wow.
And then like opponents, that's a tie as well. So strength of victory is the total points that you have scored in your wins. And that is what it would have to go to.
Well, would we win that?
Well, essentially, if the Rams lose, the Rams have to lose to Arizona to give the Seahawks a chance at the other tiebreakers. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Including, you know, in order for the tiebreaker for like opponents, the Rams have to lose to Arizona to get the Seahawks to that 5th tiebreaker. So that's a Saturday night game. Rams have already lost to Arizona this year. Seahawks have beat them twice. But if the Rams lose to Arizona and start at 9-7, then the Seahawks can simply win the division by going to Los Angeles
and defeating the Rams.
Okay. It's that simple.
Okay, so the Rams have to lose twice.
9-7, Rams would finish, 9-8. Yeah, the Rams have to lose twice.
Okay. If the Rams beat Arizona Cardinals.
That's okay. Both those teams played in St. Louis back in the day.
That's true. But if the Rams defeat the Arizona Cardinals on Saturday, our season is over, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so because they got to lose two in a row. Okay. And
those other, even if the Seahawks beat the Rams again and finish with, I guess, the same record, the Rams would win those other tiebreakers.
That is really something. Wow. Okay.
So, now, again, I personally, maybe a little biased. If you lose to your opponent early in the season, but beat them later in the season, I feel like that should be enough to win you your division. Wins the last
game? You would think.
All right.
So, real quickly, because I think you explained that better than anyone else has, this whole strength of victory criteria for making the playoff. Okay. With that said, there is a bowl game tonight in San Diego, the Holiday Bowl. It's not the Huskies, of course. They're out of bowl contention. Well, yeah. So to speak.
They get their Sun Bowl.
Sun Bowl. You're right. They get a concession bowl. But the Holiday Bowl is tonight, Washington State University versus the Syracuse Orange.
Yes, the Syracuse Orange, alma mater of,
Herb
Jim
Weisbaum.
Brown. Mm-hmm. Herb Weisbaum, if he's listening. Good morning, Mr. Weisbaum. Bob Costas as well, his alma mater. And the Holiday Bowl. The Holiday Bowl is a great bowl, or at least it used to be. It used to be a great draw. People look forward to the Holiday Bowl. It was, it wasn't the Cheez-It Bowl or the, super corporatized. It had a reputation. But Washington State, this has been probably one of the worst three-week stretches in program history. No head coach, no offensive coordinator, no defensive coordinator, no QB coach, no starting quarterback, no running back coach, and 29 players in the portal after head coach Jake Dickert ditched town to go to Wake Forest. Washington State is opening as 18-point underdogs.
Well, who's coaching them tonight, then?
In this game. Coaching them is Pete Kaligis, K-A-L-I-G-I-S. I hope I'm saying that right. Who, to his eternal credit, has stuck through the team and has commandeered the starting coaching job on the interim tag. So this is the ultimate underdog story. I mean, Syracuse is a good football team. They're ranked 22nd in the country. They finished fourth in the ACC. Washington State, of course, on that three-game slide to end the season, finished the season 8-4, but still got a good bowl draw. And they're fighters. They're tenacious. We've seen other teams vacate their bowls, Marshall in particular. But Washington State is sticking to it. And
players that are in the portal, meaning they're poised to transfer to other schools, they're playing tonight, aren't
yes.
they?
Yes. Yeah. Washington State held a team vote, actually, and said they voted for the players in the portal to have the opportunity to play. So I don't, it's the most obvious thing in the world. The system's broken, and college football is broken. But
yeah.
Washington State's going to go out there, and we know those kids are going to try their best. We know this staff is going to try their best. And I encourage, if you're not doing anything, if you want to go to San Diego, if you're a Coug, get down there, support the team, and watch the team on TV. Because this is it, and this is a big moment for the Cougs.
I think you are right. And it's tonight on Fox, so you don't have to, it's not a streaming on a pay-for.
No crazy streaming Holiday Bowl, 5 p.m. on Fox. Gus Johnson on the call, so he's a great announcer. He'll call a good game.
Excellent.
And, so that's the sports rundown.
That's the sports rundown this 27th day of December. Our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson, checking in. Thank you very much, Matthew. Great job as usual, son.
Always a pleasure. Love you, Dad, and Happy New Year.
All right. Love you, too. Okay. 7 minutes to 9 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I had said that I agree completely with Scott Jennings. The biggest scandal we've had to deal with in this country has been the sheer breadth and depth and length of the cover-up of Joe Biden's cognitive and physical decline. Have a listen. This is Jennings on CNN.
It is the biggest scandal in America, and the level and volume of people who dedicated themselves to lying to everyone at home about this man's condition for four straight years up through this summer is breathtaking. It's a scandal of epic proportions, and it's a fair question to ask who is running the country, who has been running the country. And as I said earlier, if you're worried about Donald Trump's advisors having influence, for the last 4 years, apparently this president, duly elected, but this president was not capable of fulfilling the duties of the office. And his staff and the White House lied about it and kept it from the American people. It's an absolute scandal.
See, we're beginning to learn the depth of just how bad his decline was. And now we're learning how early it was. It wasn't the last year or year and a half. It goes all the way back to his first months in office. His first months, the spring of 2021, they were having to change his schedule around because he had, quote, good days and bad, close quote. His Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, was kept at arm's length from Joe Biden. This is the woman who ran the Federal Reserve. She was kept at arm's length by staff people. His defense secretary was told that regular briefings would no longer be happening. Keep in mind, this is happening as wars had been worsening in Ukraine and Gaza. Cabinet members, cabinet officials stopped requesting meetings with the president altogether because they knew those requests would be denied by staff. Here's what we need to know next. We do need to know who carried out, who the enforcers were, who carried out this campaign, because it is disgraceful. And it was, if you think about it, it was absolutely un-American. And they were willing to actually push him out for another term if they could maintain their positions of power. Wow. Hey, let's talk again on Monday.